by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Okay, we've got just a wonderful guest and a very insightful one. And he has studied this subject for a good 35 years. Welcome to our program, Gary Fannin.
Thank you, George. Thanks for having me on.
Explain to our listening audience a little bit of your background. We're going to be covering your book tonight entitled The Innocence of Oswald. And the site is theinnocenceofoswald.com. Tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and how you came to write this book, and then we'll start talking about your book. It's a wonderful book and a wonderful site.
Well, actually, George, how I became interested in the JFK assassination was all the way back in high school. I had to do a report on a president, and luck of the draw, I drew JFK. But the way the book came about was last year when I was speaking at the Judas Conference. Several people came up to me afterwards and said, you should write a book about Oswald. You know a lot about Oswald and, how you believe he's innocent, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't think anything of it. I was like, well, that's a nice sentiment, but I really just enjoy speaking at these conferences, talking to, colleges and universities and so forth. And on the plane ride home, my wife actually said to me, she goes, well, why don't you write a book? And that's how it all came to.
Well, the wives are good at that, aren't they?
So my
yeah,
wife,
go ahead. I'm
my
sorry.
Wife was lucky enough to basically support my decision to go forward with this book. And like I said, I've been researching it for 35 years, and it all fell into place, and I'm very excited about it.
What is that subtitle? I didn't give it at the beginning, but what is your complete title of your book and the subtitle?
Well, the title is The Innocence of Oswald, and the tagline is 50-plus years of lies, deception, and deceit in the murders of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit. It's one thing for me to say I believe Oswald is innocent, but what I have done with this book is I have taken firsthand accounts, eyewitnesses, government documents that all prove that Oswald was, as he said he was, the patsy right from the very beginning, to basically show his innocence and how he was set up for the crime of the century.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject in the public. There's been numerous books written, and your site, theinnocenceoswald.com, is just a wonderful site. And I'll tell you why, Gary. You've got research click-offs in there and articles in there, all kinds of hypertext links that enable the viewer of your site to really deep research, and you've done an excellent job.
Well, I appreciate that, George. I mean, and bottom line, if you go to my website and you want to see the Warren Commission report, it's available there to you. If you want to see the House Select Committee on Assassination report, it's there for you. I literally wanted to show how the government's version does not fall in line with the basic evidence that Oswald was guilty. So that's the whole point of my book.
Right. Charlotte and I both have a military background, and I was in the Army Security Agency for 3 years in Europe and ended up in West Berlin. So we began to get, both of us, a little bit of a security and intelligence background both. And I know Charlotte, she worked on what? Other things similar.
Well,
not this.
I never worked directly with intelligence. It's good to be here with you gentlemen today. I have a question. When you were, you said in high school, you had the luck of the draw that you had John F. Kennedy as the president that was chosen for you?
Correct.
And when you first went through the material, did you, was there any particular red flags that kind of pegged your curiosity or kept you tuned in, you know, for all those years?
Yeah, well, what started it, Charlotte, was, again, my history teacher put, you know, 28, 30 names of the most interesting presidents, whatever our class size was, and like I said, luck of the draw, I drew JFK. And so by that evening, you know, my history teacher asked me, he said, are your parents both alive? And they were at the time. And he said, well, start with them, ask them where they were at, because anybody that was alive during the time of the assassination knows where they were and what exactly they were doing. Well, so that's where I started. And what I did was, in the meantime, again, this was 1980, before the Internet, so you actually had to go to the library. You had to look at microfilm. And what I found interesting was, I'm looking at the Dallas Morning News from November 22nd, November 23rd. I'm looking at the Fort Worth Star Telegram. I'm looking at New York Post. I mean, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, everything. And what really blew me away was how over 200 eyewitnesses could have gotten the description so wrong, yet seven members of the Warren Report 9 months later could say, oh, no, everybody else was wrong. This is exactly how it happened. And that's where I started. When I originally, Charlotte, wrote my report, I originally wrote it that I thought Oswald was, part of the plan and that he had an accomplice. And that changed immediately the first time I went to Dallas and actually stood in Dealey Plaza and actually stood in the Texas School Book Depository building, because this was back before it was a museum. But when you're actually standing there for the first time and you go, if I'm Oswald, I wouldn't wait till they're driving away over here. I would, take care of the, if I was shooting at JFK, I would have shot at him when he's coming up Houston Street.
Right. Charlotte and I did a 4-hour broadcast live from the lobby of the Texas School Book Depository a number of years ago.
Museum.
That was quite
yeah.
exciting. Yeah, the yeah. museum, Texas School Book Depository Museum.
Right.
And that was quite informative. Was that magic bullet theory and all that just to you just obviously an invention? What were your thoughts there?
It was definitely, to me, it was definitely something that was the government had to have plausible, just simply for the timing of the shots. And, again, no expert could recreate what Oswald allegedly did. And Oswald, the problem is everybody, especially back in 1963, 1964, well, he was a marksman. He was a great shot. Well, actually, a marksman is the lowest level you get in the Marines. It's the wording that they used, to describe Oswald as being such a great shot. I just found out from interviewing, Ron Lewis and some other people that he wasn't a great shot. He only qualified to the sharpshooter level on one particular set of testing, and that was after 3 weeks of intensive training with shooting. So he wasn't that great of a shot, and bottom line, the magic bullet could not traverse seven different ones from people, fraction of really small, have 14 grams of weight basically taken out of the bullet. If you actually look at the x-rays of John Connolly's wrist, there's more bullet fragments left in his wrist than supposedly is a good thing from the magic bullet. So that's when I knew, and, this wasn't a valid bullet. This was a believed bullet.
You have some amazing photographs also on your site of the trajectory, possible trajectory and origin of some of those shots, and that's totally, insightful. So it was a short, there were several more, shooter and deposit that day?
Yeah, I actually have, I believe, 7 or 8 different teams of shooters. I will be the first to admit, George and Charlotte, that I can only pinpoint 2 people in the locator, and that's based off of, the evidence that I found. I believe Mac Wallace in the 6-4, just simple as the fingerprint that was listed in 63 that was verified in 1998 by Professor Walt Brown, and he was LBJ's hit. He had killed for LBJ pass. So I know for a fact that he had to be there if his fingerprint was found in that area. And more importantly, the Roscoe story, a lot of people believe in the Roscoe White story that Ricky's son was just trying to get fame and money. That was not Ricky's point at all. I literally, thanks to Gary Shaw, who is one of the premier researchers in the JFK assassination. I showed the open interview for him. He let me go down to the Baylor University Library, where he has all files and everything sealed off in a special room, humidity, climate control, and so forth. And we tested the paper they were in with BM and 3M. Both of them came back and said it was either 1962, 1963 paper and plastic stock. You know, Roscoe White admitted in his witness elimination program book, which I had my hands on, he admitted that he had killed 28 people to cover up the assassination. He admitted to shooting two shots at JFK from about 8 to 10 feet down the west part of the picket fence. He admitted to killing an officer at 10th and Patton. He didn't say Officer Tippett. He just said he killed a police officer at 10th and Patton as well. So with all the documentation that I was able to verify and validate, I firmly believe that Roscoe White was in the position he claimed that he was in. And again, on his deathbed, he confessed to his priest, Reverend Shaw, Jack Shaw, that he had killed 28 people on foreign and domestic soil to help cover up the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Well, I'll tell you what, Gary, doesn't he have an insight in this? That I've talked to several people, but Gary, you have quite an insight. What'd you say, Cheryl? Charlotte?
So Roscoe White, he admitted on his deathbed that they killed 28 people to continue the cover-up?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, he was tied into naval intelligence, is that correct?
Correct. And the three decoded cables that I have in my book, that again, we tested for the authenticity of the age of the documents from 62 and 63, one of them is from September of 63, and I don't have it right here in front of me, but it's from Naval Intelligence, and it has a number, a seven-digit number, 1666106, which was Roscoe White's Marine identification number, and it's from Naval Intelligence. It says September of 63, and it literally says Remarks Mandarin, which was the code name that Roscoe White claimed that he went by. People that have researched the assassination, they've heard of Mandarin, they've heard of Lebanon, they've heard of Saul. He was Mandarin. The remarks are Mandarin. It says, Dallas destination chosen. This is the first cable in September 16th. It says, Dallas destination chosen.
Right.
Your place hidden within the department. You know, basically a wait for further details. And basically what this first document is saying is that they have decided, Naval Intelligence has contacted somebody with the Dallas Police Department, and they are basically going to hire Roscoe White to be a police officer with the Dallas Police.
Right.
And what I found interesting after that was the next cable, which is for October of 63, again, the same remarks. It says Naval Intelligence. It has 166106, and again, it's marked and dated for oversea, and it says, Remarks Mandarin, full affairs assignments have been canceled. The next assignment is to eliminate a national security threat to White. Destination will be Houston, Austin, or Dallas. Contacts are being arranged now. Orders are subject to change at any time. Reply back if not understood. This one document, Charlotte and George, basically says, we are not going to kill Fidel Castro. We're going to kill John F. Kennedy.
Right. Was Roscoe White, did he have a diary that disappeared? His son gave it to the FBI or something? Was there something way back I heard about? Is that correct information?
Yeah, his son Ricky actually found the diary and the cables and the photographs and everything back in 1982. And he slowly started reading them. I mean, Ricky was a young guy at the time, probably 21, 24, somewhere in that range, and really didn't want to believe what he was reading. And finally, in 1987, 88 range, he went public with the information, even contacted the Dallas office of the FBI, and basically they came out and interviewed him and everything, and he showed them the diary. He showed them the elimination witness program book. He showed them photographs that he had that nobody else had. And basically what ended up happening was he claims, and I have no reason to break you on this, he claims that while he was in another room, the FBI came back to the room where his wife was at and said that they had left their notes behind. Basically, they copied his diary in 1988.
When
Ricky went to the Kennedy Assassination Information Center in 1990 to Gary Shaw and Larry Howard, he was telling them this information, and obviously they were very interested, but when they asked him, well, can we see the diary, he's like, well, the FBI took it. So obviously they're being a little bit skeptical at that point. But again, they were the first people to really look at the three decoded cables, have them tested and so forth, to find out the authenticity. And again, he had photographs that, he had the ghost image of Oswald, for example, where it looks like, Oswald's body, his face has been superimposed, for the backyard photographs.
Oh, that was a cockeyed head on that body, wasn't it? Wasn't it cockeyed a little bit?
Yeah.
Where it looked fake?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, the shadow lines on the face are completely different from what's on the ground. And if you look,
right.
if you look at the photographs very closely, Roscoe White was almost the exact same size and build as Oswald. And in the backyard photographs, Oswald has a more squared off chin instead of a pointed chin. Well, basically the chin to the lower lip was still Roscoe White. And Roscoe White, by the way, one of his assignments when he was in the military with Oswald was photographic expertise. And so I feel those photographs were doctored. And even Lee Harvey Oswald, when he was shown the photographs in police custody, said, they're fakes, and I can prove to you that they're fakes.
Right. This Oswald in the doorway, tell us about that. What is that about?
Well, that is a big controversy, and I don't say it's definitely Oswald. I will say it definitely looks like him. Researcher Robert Grodin said way back in, I believe, 1976, that the image that people think is Oswald was actually a gentleman by the name of Billy Nolan Lovelady. And it may very well be Lovelady, okay? But the problem that I have with it is when Lovelady was asked to identify himself in the doorway, he did not, the image was Oswald. He pointed to another guy that's in the shadow area and has his hands up near his face. Regardless of which one is Billy Nolan Lovelady, or even if Oswald is standing there, Captain Fritz asked Oswald, where were you at the time of the assassination? And Oswald's testimony was, I was out front with Bill Shelley, which was a co-worker in the depository building. So whether you believe that image is Oswald or not, if he had gone to a court of law, gone to trial, I mean, you have to take into account his testimony. And if he says he was out front and there's pictures of someone that looks remarkably like him, Judith Barry Baker has done some excellent pixel work to show that the shirt of the image that appears to be Oswald is the same shirt that he was wearing when he was arrested. And again, it was open to, his mid-chest diaphragm area. It looks very eerily like Oswald. I never say specifically in the book that image is him. But again, if you take that image and with his statement, you have to believe he's out front only for the fact that otherwise you have to believe the Warren Commission that he fired three shots with world-class precision, ran approximately 200 feet to the other side of the building, wiped the gun full clean of fingerprints, ran down four flights of steps, ran another 100 feet to the lunchroom, bought a Coke, and when Officer Baker shows up less than 90 seconds after the assassination with a gun drawn on Oswald, he's not nervous, he's not out of breath, he's not sweating, it can't be done. I mean, I'm just saying, can't be done.
Yeah, Gary, did Lee Harvey Oswald have advance notice of what was to happen that day or not? What's your best comment on that?
I believe Lee knew something was going to happen. I believe he was drawn in to be a shooter, and I believe at the last minute he obviously pulled out and decided not to. From everything that I've ever researched and read about Oswald, he was a supporter of John F. Kennedy. Now, that doesn't mean as a CIA guy or an ONI guy, that you can't, be asked to do something that you don't want to do if you're following orders. But again, I don't believe Oswald fired a shot. I do believe he knew something was going to happen. I wish he would have done a little bit more than what he did. You know, I wish he would have ran out in the streets or something. Who knows? But
well, Judith Berry Baker is saying that that there was a Chicago hit that he thwarted. Is there substance to that?
There's a lot of substance to that.
Okay.
Thomas Arthur Valley was his name. A plot was in Chicago. I believe JFK was there to attend the Army-Navy game or something. He was there for a football game. And this Thomas Arthur Valley, again, a former Marine, had just taken a job right on the motorcade route, the whole nine yards, and supposedly an FBI informant just by the name of Lee. They never say Lee Oswald, but an FBI informant by the name of Lee notified the Chicago Police Department and the Chicago FBI and Secret Service that there was going to be an attempt, and gave the name of the guy. And the Chicago police eventually went out, found the guy at his apartment. He had like 2,500 rounds of ammunition, several rifles. And again, that plot was basically thwarted. Other plots in November 18th in Tampa and Miami were also changed. Due to surveillance and so forth, but for whatever reason, the Dallas plot, went through.
To the best of your knowledge and research, were there several different cities that were laid out to take out JFK? If one didn't materialize, another one would be used. And my second follow-up question was the bubble top. Who actually authorized that to be taken out or requested that to be taken off the JFK limousine?
Well, as far as the other side book, I have six cities listed. I have Chicago, Tampa, and Miami, which all three were controlled heavily by the mafia. And the other three cities are Houston, Austin, and Dallas. And I base that on the second decoded cable that says the destination will be Houston, Austin, or Dallas, where they're putting Roscoe White into the Dallas Police Department. Well, if they're putting Roscoe in Dallas, that means they had another Naval Intelligence CIA guy in Austin that was set up if they decided to do the assassination there. They had another guy in Houston set up in case it happened there. So in my belief, those were the six cities that they were targeting, again, from November 2nd until the actual assassination on November 22nd. As far as the bubble top being removed, I cannot remember off the top of my head now. I can't remember if it was Kellerman or who it was, but it was a Secret Service agent that removed the bubble top. The best person to ask on that would be Vince Palomara. He's the expert on the Secret Service. But Vince did tell me that the Secret Service did violate 16 different rules of presidential protection just on the Fort Worth-Dallas part of the trip.
My gosh, so it was really planned well, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, Vince, I interviewed him last year, and we put it out on the conference for the audience last year. But the public is just really wanting a definitive bottom line on this, and they just keep asking. They keep researching this, don't they? Huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't think 52 years after the fact that there's still that much, information available, but it's still available if you have the right resources and you're not afraid to ask the proper questions.
Right. Donald Gibson, a professor at New York University, has come up with one of the reasons of why JFK was taken out. And he says he put forward the idea that JFK wanted to establish détente with the Soviet Union. And Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, they wanted to begin a Cold War that would fill a munitions industry for America. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I totally agree. The military-industrial complex, CIA, they wanted and needed that war for the Cold War to happen, or obviously for money purposes, defense contracts, and so forth. But I definitely believe that President Kennedy and Khrushchev were working out secret arrangements. And as a matter of fact, Bobby Kennedy and Jacqueline Kennedy, the Sunday after the assassination, sent one of their closest aides to Russia to speak with the Russian Premier's secretary to let them know that, hey, this is, you know, they're going to blame, you know, the Soviet Union, they're going to blame Khrushchev, they're going to blame Castro. And Bobby and Jackie Kennedy sent somebody to let them know that this is a domestic incident. Okay, don't believe what they're going to say is happening, because they're going to try to put the blame on the Soviet Union, Khrushchev, and Castro, which was entirely, you know, ludicrous. Castro had even admitted immediately after the assassination that this was a bad thing for Cuba.
Right.
So,
New Orleans seems to figure prominently in a location where many of the conspirators were operating, did it not?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, when you go back to all of the people involved in the New Orleans part of the assassination, you know, David Ferry, Guy Bannister, you know, Clay Shaw, you know, all these people. But bottom line, you know, when you bring the mafia into it, you have to also look at Carlos Marcello, again, from New Orleans. So I don't doubt without, you know, any reasonable doubt that the mafia was involved, but I believe they were involved strictly in the part of providing men to do the shooting.
Right.
In my opinion, they did not arrange the assassination. They obviously could not cover it up. They couldn't change everything that needed to be done. Only elements of our own U.S. government could do everything that's required in order for JFK to be assassinated and the subsequent follow-up for the past 52 years.
Carlos Marcello, was he not deported twice?
I believe so. He was actually deported, I believe, either he was deported that day or just got back into the country the day Kennedy was assassinated.
I think he was in court and in a deportation, hearing, I believe, on the day of 22nd November.
Right, and then I think after that he got deported to Guatemala somewhere, I believe.
Yeah, my understanding on Carlos Marcello is that when he and his family first, his mom and his aunt, first entered the United States into New Orleans, I believe they gave his origin of birth as Guatemala for
right, and he deported it. Right.
That's why they deported him back to the country of birth. See what
yeah.
And that's sort of my understanding quite a bit, a few people, you know, around that been on different aspects of this over the year. I've researched this, too.
Yeah, I know that for a fact,
yeah. I mean, I'm the one of the two of you, Charlotte and Gary, that was alive when it happened. I think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Your babies come back to old Georgie.
Yeah, it's funny, George, because when I did that original history report, and I put this in the introduction of my
okay.
campers, and they, you know, they broke into the television news. And I said, well, wait a minute, Mom. I said, you know, because I had already done a little bit of homework. I said, he was killed at, you know, 12:30 Central Time, you know, on a Friday. And we were kids. We had lived in Nanny Sunday to Friday because both of my parents in the 60s, which was very unusual. And I said to my mom, I said, what were you doing home from work on the middle of a Friday afternoon? And she goes, well, I just got back from the doctor and found out I was pregnant with your ass.
Well, get the goodie, isn't it? A $1 million tragedy. Hey, Gary, you know, there are some family things that are just damn right funny in a way, aren't they, huh? Look at the family secrets. Family secrets.
And George and Sharp, that's a little bit eerie, is I started probably 1999, 2000. I started looking at, you know, the death of JFK as far as, like, how old was he? He was exactly 46 years and one shy of 6 months. At the time of his assassination. So I projected that time out to when, you know, when is 46 years and 3 weeks, you know, in my lifetime? Because I really thought with my karma, a study in JFK like I had for at that point almost 20 years, you know, I thought, well, something, you know, is going to happen to me that day. And so I had told friends for probably a dozen years, you know, that I said, you know, January 24th, 2011, I don't know what's going to happen that day, but it's not going to be a good day for me, because that would have been the exact day in my lifetime that JFK would have lived, and my mother passed away that day.
No.
Well, when I had drawn JFK's name out of the hat at school and I had to do a report, my history teacher told me to, you know, go ask my parents where they were. So when I went home, I asked my parents, where were you when, you know, JFK was killed? And my mom said, well, I was here watching my, you know, soap operas, and they, you know, they broke into the soap opera on the TV news and said JFK had been shot at.
And so I had, you know, done a little bit of my homework at that point. I said, well, wait a minute, Mom. I said, you know, when we were a kid, you know, when we were kids, we had a live-in nanny from Sunday to Friday. I said, you know, what were you doing home at 12:30 on, you know, a Friday afternoon? Because my mom and dad worked in the early 60s, which was rare at the time, so we had the live-in nanny. And my mom said to me, she goes, well, I just got back from the doctor and found out I was pregnant with your ass. So my mom found out. She was pregnant with me the day JFK was killed. So.
Oh, man, I tell you, that's quite interesting. And I think I injected in there that you ought to write a book, Fannin Family Secrets or something. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
But,
yeah, it was fascinating.
Well, one of the questions I have for you is why are we still studying this at this late date with, 52 years after the event happened? What would be your ideas? And also, Charlotte, I want you to chime in also. But first, Gary, why are we doing this? Why are we still doing this?
Because, bottom line, America lost its innocence on November 22nd, 1963, and we've never believed the official government story of the Warren Commission, of the House Select Committee on Assassination. We've never believed it. And when you combine with that the elements of Watergate, and everything else that has happened in the ensuing 50 years, how our government's lying to us, you know, I guess they just wonder, well, where else are they lying to us about it? You know, because, again, one of the chapters that I cover in my book, one of my chapters is called Mainstream Media Equals CIA. And I go into how the CIA, all the way back in 1953, with Operation Mockingbird, was basically controlling the vast majority of the major news that was going out there. So that's why I feel it's still relevant today, is because I don't think the American people, you know, firmly believe in what they're going to tell us is happening. You know, again, you can go all the way back to 1947 with the Roswell, New Mexico incident if you want to. The faith in the elected officials of our country, we just don't believe them anymore. And it's amazing, this in my book as well, that we have between 1964 and today, we've had anywhere from 51 to 81% of the American public that believes it's a conspiracy to kill JFK. Yet, ironically, every single president that's been elected since 1963, every single vice president, all 435 members of the House and the 100 members of the Senate and the 9 appointed judges of the Supreme Court, they always side with the Warren Commission. So you basically have approximately 546 elected and appointed individuals in this country that is governing 330 million people, and they're telling us what happened. I don't believe it.
Right. Charlotte, what would be your comments about the same question?
Yeah, well, actually, it's I don't want to deviate too far, but your book is such a – you must have a lot of younger, you know, high school students and college students who are seeking out your book to write their own papers, because I'm assuming we still write about the presidents, and this assassination is something that people still write about in higher education. But so do you get a lot of young people that are tasked with running across this information for the first time?
Well, it's ironic you say that, Charlotte, because not only do I have a lot of young people, but I also have, even a lot of elderly people asking me questions about it. My kids, one's in college now, but, in 10th grade, he asked me to go to his history class, to talk to the history teacher about a report that he had wrote about JFK. And obviously he had a pretty good, background by listening to me a lot. But basically, the teacher gave him a C minus on the report, said it was all conjecture, he had no proof, blah, blah, blah. And so he asked me to go in and talk to his history teacher. And so I went in and I said, well, here's the proof. He's got this listed here. He's got this listed here. He's got this, you know, unless it's grammatically incorrect and you gave him a C minus, but, you know, you can't knock him for it. And bottom line, that history teacher and I now are such good friends that even though my son has been out of high school for 2 years now, I still go back about 3 or 4 times a year and give speeches and lectures at that school.
Oh, man, Gary, that's beautiful. Spread the truth, man. You know,
I volunteer at a retirement community, And I go in and talk history every Friday. As a matter of fact, I'm here right now. I'm getting ready here in the next hour. I go in and I talk history to Tyrese.
Oh, man, that's great.
So people from
2 years.
People from 16 to 86 are listening to me.
Now, they still have the disinformation specialists out there, and I'll give you an example. 2 years ago was the 50th anniversary, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, now, in Austin, we have a Texas Book Festival. They invited one of the members of the Warren Commission down who had written a book about the magic bullet theory, and he reiterated was, boy, that's what they found out. They were pondering, well, how could this happen? Hours after hours, the Warren Commission, he was a counsel to the Warren Commission. How could this happen? And then all of a sudden, it was unraveled by that another counsel on the Warren Commission. Oh, it was that single bullet, you know, did this. You know what I mean?
Right. Well,
so that was, given to the audience.
Yeah, our inspector who came up with it. He called it the single bullet conclusion.
Yeah. Well, you know what this guy said? This guy said, he said, we were pondering for hours wondering how all of this could happen. And then our inspector jumped up and he said, I got it. It was a single bullet. You know, Shakespearean tragic play, right? You know, then they also had at that same book festival, this reporter from the Dallas Morning News, you know who I'm talking about? He was not on this story that day, but quickly started picking it up. Of course, he just reiterated the standard government, Lee Harvey Oswald.
You gotta be talking about Hugh Ainsworth.
What? Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they had him, and then they had this other guy that wrote the book about the single bullet theory being it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so it got to be so ridiculous, you know. But the public was just sitting there taking it in, you know.
I've met Hugh Ainsworth several times, and he brags that he's the only local reporter to be at all four. For major crime scenes, that he was at the Kennedy assassination, he was at Parkland Hospital, he was, at the Tippit crime scene, he was, at the Texas Theater, and, I simply asked him, I said, well, if you were the only major reporter at all four of these major events, and you covered it better than anybody else, why did Merriman Smith win the Pulitzer that year? Why aren't you in the Why aren't you in the Warren Report for testimony?
Did you do any consulting for the JFK movie or not?
I'm sorry?
Did you do any consulting for Oliver Smith on the JFK movie?
Oliver Stone, yes.
Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone, thank you for correcting me.
I did work on the Stone movie. I will tell you this, George and Charlotte, just for your listeners, because, again, I don't want to brag and say that I did something I didn't do or whatever, but I am listed as an uncredited assistant technical advisor. I was hired by Larry Howard at the Kennedy Assassination Information Center. And bottom line, there was a lot of people that worked on it that were not listed in the credits just simply because they don't want to pay royalties. I mean, they'll pay you a flat paycheck and ask you for your help and guidance and so forth. But they don't want to pay the royalties if it's a success. And, that movie was obviously a success. I mean, I would still be making money off of that movie if I would have been credited in it.
You know what I did? I had a bunch of my nieces and nephews down from Seattle area, actually right there east of Tacoma, Puyallup, I think is the area. And so I took them all out to the movie, to the JFK Oliver Stone movie, and they got up and we had a big talk afterwards and they'll say, well, Uncle George, what do you think about this? I say it's pretty close,
Yeah, and
it wasn't too far off. What did you think, Gary and Charlotte?
I think it was spot on. I mean,
it was.
I even mentioned in my book, Stone and Zachary Squire, they took a few what I call liberties for dramatic purposes. But, I specifically list them in my book. The Michael Rooker character was a composite of two different district attorneys. The character that I can't remember her name right now, Lori Metcalf, who was on Roseanne as Roseanne's younger sister. She was an assistant DA in the movie JFK. She was an assistant DA on Garrison's staff. And the real reality of the fact is he didn't have a female district attorney, assistant district attorney on his staff. But for political correct reasons, he wanted a woman, you know, in the movie. The biggest thing that everybody says, well, that didn't happen. That's just made up. That's just Hollywood dramatic thing is, you know, in the movie JFK, Jim Garrison goes to Washington, D.C. to meet with Colonel X, you know, who is in reality was a CIA liaison to the Pentagon by the name of Colonel Fletcher Prouty.
L. Fletcher Prouty was a good stand-up guy.
Fletcher passed away about a dozen years or so ago. And in reality, in the movie, Garrison went to see Fletcher Prouty, and basically Fletcher Prouty was telling him, you know, hey, here's what you got to do. You got to, you know, do all this stuff. And in reality, what happened was after the trial of Playshaw was over, Fletch came down to see Garrison in New Orleans to show him how the CIA and the military industrial complex had sabotaged his trial.
Really?
So, I mean, little things like that that were done for dramatic purposes. You know, something else that most people don't know, but anytime you watch the movie JFK, when you watch that movie today, okay, when you see a scene that is filmed in black and white, that is simply Oliver Stone subjecting for you, the viewer, to make up your own viewpoint. Do you think it happened this way or this way? There are several scenes in that movie that are shot in black and white, and it usually begins with Garrison or whoever talking. Well, what if this happened, people? Or what if this happened? Or what if this, you know, so when he shows you scenes with that and then shows a scene filmed in black and white, he was doing that solely for the purpose of taking you back in time to 1963. If you were there, would you believe Oswald's side or would you believe the government's side?
Right. There was a booklet being handed out by Lee Harvey Oswald on the streets of New Orleans. And he was doing a pro-Cuban a demonstration there at one time. Lee Harvey Oswald was
correct. Yeah,
and I tracked down who wrote that booklet. Do you know who wrote that booklet?
I do not.
Carlos Lamont. His father was Thomas W. Lamont that met on Jekyll Island, put the Federal Reserve together for J.P. Morgan interest. Can you believe that? They come at us from the left and the right, don't they? Now, Carlos Lamont, and he disavows this in a book on humanism that he wrote. He wrote an excellent book on humanism. That's how I picked up his name originally. And then, of course, I went in and dug down in the Warren Commission archives and got you can actually get a copy of that booklet, okay?
Wow.
But Carlos Lamont, avowed Marxist communist, wrote all kinds of pieces in pro-Soviet, pro-Cuba. And that booklet that was handed out by Lee Harvey Oswald was written by Carlos Lamont. So the point I'm trying to make is they come at us from the left, communist left, and they come at us from the right, the hard right, land right, see?
Oh, exactly.
And they got everybody in America all mixed up, and everybody's, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm on the left, I'm on the right. And they just got everybody just, you know what I mean, mind-washed, you know?
I agree entirely, and if you listen any to Roger Stone, he'll tell you that both the Democrats and the Republicans, they're both being pulled by the same strings. They're both, you know, taking the same financial kickbacks. I mean, we don't have a two-party system anymore.
No, let me say this. The JFK assassination, did that mark a point in our American history where the country started being taken down?
Oh, exactly.
What do you think?
Like I said, that's where I believe that, you know, America, you know, finally lost faith in the government. You know,
right.
you have to look at, you know, the early works. You know, look at Mark Lane's book and film Rush to Judgment, 1967. You know,
yeah.
Mark Lane was hired.
He was taken to court on that, wasn't he?
Yeah. And Mark Lane.
And he
was,
won.
You know,
he won in court. He won in court.
Represent our dead son.
And he won in court too.
Yeah.
Mark Lane did.
Yep.
Yeah.
And not only
so
that.
So go ahead.
Not
continue.
Only that, but I mean, to give you an idea, you know, Gerald Posner's book from 1994, Case Closed or whatever, was, you know, a huge New York Times bestseller. And again, saying that, you know, Oswald had the mental capabilities, to do it, and that, he had, done through computer programming that it was possible for Oswald to do this, not mentioning what motive Oswald would have. But later on, when it came out that Gerald Posner was plagiarizing a lot of his book, he hired Mark Lane as his attorney to represent him in court on the Kennedy assassination over his own book that he had plagiarized.
Oh, my God. It gets complicated, doesn't it, Gary?
And he won.
I mean, I'm trying. My mind is being boggled by this. I'm learning all kinds of good things. You know what I mean?
Well,
you're very insightful, and you're really revealing quite a bit of the truth.
Oh, and Gary, you've done a wonderful job using source documents. I mean, that is fantastic. The way you bring that forward, it's your, you know, you put that right out front. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and like I said, it's not just my viewpoint in the book. I have to, you know, in my own ideas when I started writing this book last year was, okay, I've believed for 25, 30 years now that Oswald's been innocent. But how do I prove it? And how I proved it was, again, through government documents, through, you know, through ballistics, through autopsies. You know, what they're claiming Oswald did is just preposterous. How did he get from his rooming house at 1026 North Beckway to 10th and Patton, 8/10 of a mile away without a car in under 2 minutes?
Yeah,
without being winded.
We might get into Star Trek where they could materialize in there.
We're getting
into science fiction here, right?
the way that the Warren Commission depicted that was, they said that Tippett was killed at 1:15, okay? Well, in reality, when you look at the documents in my book, the Warren Commission's main eyewitness that said Oswald killed Tippett was a woman by the name of Helen Markham. I have in my book Helen Markham's signed affidavit that says at 1:06 p.m., this man shot Officer Tippett 3 or 4 times. Well, he left his rooming house at 1:04. He shot Tippett almost a mile away, you know, 2 minutes later. And what the government did, what the Warren Commission did, was they simply took the time that Officer Tippett's body arrived at Methodist Hospital. It was pronounced DOA by the medical staff at 1:15. So they just changed it to, well, he died at 1:15, so 1:04 to 1:15, he had 11 minutes to cover less than a mile.
So they just sort of made up history, didn't they, huh? A little bit distorted?
And they continued to do it.
The invention of history. That's why they bring these disinformation specialists back in, because the young people don't know any better on some of this stuff. See what I mean? And they'll just lap it up and say, oh, this happened, that happened. So they're just continuous propaganda on this subject.
Well, and again, keep this in mind, too, on Officer Tippett's autopsy performed on Dr. Earl Rose at Parkland, who should have done the autopsy on JFK. On autopsy, Dr. Rose removed 2 .38 revolver bullets and 2 .38 automatic bullets. Well, Oswald only owned the .38 revolver. The bullets are not interchangeable. So Oswald had an accomplice, or Oswald owned another gun that nobody's been able to pin on him for 52 years, or Oswald somehow was able to take a bullet that is a half inch longer and put it into a revolver and somehow make it fit and work, or he didn't do it at all. And when you look at the FBI report that says that he has no gunpowder burns on his hands or his cheek, when you look at the nitrate testing that proves, you know, that he didn't, you know, even fire a weapon, you know, and here's the other thing too. You know, people say, well, he tried to fight his way out of the Texas theater and his gun misfired. Well, yeah, the revolver supposedly misfired because the firing pin didn't line up with the bullet chamber. Well, if it didn't line up at 1:40, how did it line up at 1:06 to shoot Tippett?
Yeah, exactly. The good point there, Gary.
Gosh.
Yeah. I mean, that is, yeah, duh, you know what I mean? There's just all kinds of bullet holes
like
in this
that.
Story, isn't there?
Yeah.
Hey, there's all kinds of bullet holes in the story, right?
Exactly.
To say, you know, the lead. And it just doesn't. Now, there is one aspect of this. Is there any substance or to the two Oswald theory or not?
I've gone round and round, George and Charlotte, on that.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that somebody was, you know, being an imposter. John Armstrong has written a book called Harvey and Lee. I don't go into that in my book, just simply because, to me, whether he's being, impersonated or not, with the Mexico City incidents and everything else, it really doesn't pertain to me with the actual assassination itself. So I don't, and again, I'm not discounting it. I don't bring it up in my book. I don't speak a lot about the three tramps in my book. Was it Getney and Holt and Abrams? Was it, Hunt? Was it Harrelson? Was it this guy? I don't go into that because even if they were spotters for the shooters, I don't think that they were responsible. So again, areas that I couldn't prove one way or the other, I pretty much left out of my book. And again, I'm not doubting that it's there. You look at the pictures of Oswald from Russia versus the time that he, is killed. He looks entirely different. Paul Grudy, Paul Grudy, the mortician that embalmed Oswald and buried him, and when they exhumed him in 1981, Paul Grudy says the head that was in there in 1981 was the same one I put in there in 1963. So, I don't doubt that there could be two people. I don't have any way of proving it or disproving it.
Right. I've examined now, according to the Warren Commission and their archives, they have a passport. Oh, I know what the question I want to pose to you may be more relevant than anything. Was there a false defection program underway where they would put forward defectors to Russia that were fake?
Most definitely. I mean, that program was going on. I cannot remember the name of it off the top of my head, but that program was going on. They try to make Oswald to be the lone nut, couldn't keep a job, uneducated. When in reality, again, in my book, I've got documents that prove that he had the highest security clearance you could have of confidential. He was responsible for the U-2 spy planes flying over Russia, the radio, part of that. He was tested in the military and had an IQ of 152, okay? This was not a stupid man. He taught himself Russian. Okay.
Right.
One of the most difficult languages out there. But the defector plan, that is entirely. I totally believe that happened. And again, I don't go into it much in my book, but I do believe in it.
I went to the archives and looked at that passport photograph. And then also there's a photograph of Oswald supposedly coming back from Russia, above a railing. It was shot from a wharf, I guess. A landing wharf or something. Those two photographs do not look like the Oswald shot in Dallas. They just don't look the same.
No, they do not. I agree entirely.
So, are they fake pictures or was this part of the, did they send one Oswald over to do on the fake defection program and the other one stayed here? Was something possible?
It's possible. I haven't gone into the Harvey and the Lee side of it as much. Eventually, the blame comes back solely on the Harvey Oswald, whether or not he was being impersonated or not. Again, I think it's entirely possible. I just don't go into it a whole lot into my book.
Right. We've got about 5 minutes left, Gary Fannin. And would you like to add some closing comments or some details that maybe might be pertinent to your book and tell us your site of your book and so forth?
Well, you can go to my website, which is www.theinnocenceofoswald.com. It's all lowercase. In my website, I have a lot of documents on there. The FBI documents stating that, a scraping from the inside part of the windshield, which, of course, 9 months later they said, there wasn't a shot through the windshield. I have probably 25 to 30 photographs in my photo gallery, and all of those images in the photo gallery are basically showing how, if you believe Oswald was guilty, how do you explain this? And one of my favorite photographs in that collection is it's a still picture from a Robert Hughes 8mm film, and he offered this to J. Edgar Hoover, and Hoover said that it had no evidentiary value because it did not show the building from which the shots were fired. Well, not only does it show the Texas School Book Depository building, it shows the sixth floor. And in that sixth floor window, you do not see a gun protruding out of the window, and at the time, JFK's car is directly below it. You know, other images in that same photo, it already shows Lyndon Johnson's Secret Service follow-up car has got the door open, sending him a message that basically something's about to occur. Lyndon Johnson by Rufus Youngblood, the Secret Service agent, when he went to cover Johnson when the shots started ringing out, Rufus Youngblood, in his own testimony, said, either Johnson knew something or he's one jumpy son of a bitch because he was already on the floor by the time I turned around to cover him up.
This I heard, and I knew some from, can't say who they are, I knew Secret Service agents that covered him after he retired. And I got the same story from some of the Secret Service agents that worked for him here in Austin and up on, you know what I mean, his ranch, you know, the LBJ ranch.
Right, the LBJ ranch there.
So, I would say at Stonewall, you know, up there, Pertinalis, you know, and all that.
Right.
So I got over the years, I got, you know, some of that feedback from real Secret Service agents, not third party or anything, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
And
I'm a firm believer that, you know, no matter what your age, if you ever get to Dallas, you got to go to Dealey Plaza. But especially this time of the year, spend $100, spend $150, go to Judas Conference, go to the other conferences that are out there. You can learn something from all of them. Unfortunately,
right.
John just passed away, and so they're probably not doing the COPA conference this year. But
right. He was a friend of mine, too, yeah. I knew John Judge, and we interviewed him when Charlotte and I were in there on that 4 hours at the Texas School Book Depository Museum. We interviewed John Judge the last hour that year we were up there, and they didn't know who we were. Charlotte got us in there, didn't you, Charlotte?
I believe so.
Charlotte got us in there, and they didn't know who in the heck we were, you know? So we started off our interview with that Waldorf Astoria speech that JFK gave. And
right.
We pretended we were at that speech, okay?
Well,
Charlotte and I did. We said
for the radio listeners.
Yeah, for the radio listeners. So it was like a spoof, you know. But it worked. And then we had Alan Watt on there, and we had John Judge and some other people. Well, any other closing comments that you'd have, Gary Fannin?
You know, just don't believe 100% of what the government's telling you. Don't believe what the politicians will tell you. Do your own homework, do your own research. Like I said, if you get a chance to go to Dallas, go to Judas Conference. She has got some phenomenal speakers again this year. I was a speaker at her conference last year. Last year, Judith asked me to give the prayer and remarks at Oswald's gravesite, which was a tremendous honor for me as well. So it was.
Yes.
It's just very informative to go to some of these forums.
Yeah, it's www.jfkconference.com. Again, let me repeat
correct.
That for our listening audience, www.jfkconference.com. And you can find all the speakers and all the information and sign up and buy a ticket. I'll be up there producing the video again this year, the second year in a row. Charlotte, any closing comments from you?
Well, can you tell us about your upcoming travels a little bit?
You got a minute.
Either of you going to the JFK in the next couple of weeks? Are you doing anything, the conference then?
Oh, yeah. I'm going out November 18th to 24th. I'm speaking at a luncheon, Chris Gallup's luncheon in Mansfield, Texas, with Jim Mars and Barr McClellan are the two main headliners. I have an author's table at both Judas Conference and JFK Lancer. Kind of a backup speaker, I guess, if somebody happens to cancel out at the last minute or whatever. But I'll be out there the entire time, just like I am every year in November.
Okay, Gary Fannin, thank you. Yeah, Charlotte and Gary Fannin, thank you very much for the interview. And, boy, we're putting some truth out there, and we appreciate your time spent and all your effort, okay?